I'd like to open the services by reading to you from the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians, chapter 1, and in his introductory comments, beginning at verse 1. It says, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, by the will of God, and Timothy our brother, unto the church of God which is at Corinth, with all the saints which are all Achaia, grace be to you and peace from God our Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ. Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. It's interesting and wonderful to think that Paul spoke of God as the God of comfort, the God of consolation. The term there is similar to the term that I shared with you a few weeks back, the parakletos, the idea of a comforter, the idea of somebody who comes and stands with you, has a share in your life, has a share and stands with you and for you. In this letter, Paul is writing perhaps from Ephesus. He's now had several years under his belt of ministering. He's had many oppositions. He's had many problems. He's been thrown in jail a few times. He's been beaten a few times. And nevertheless, he reaches out in his heart in this letter to the church at Corinth, the second letter that we have recorded for us in Holy Writ. And he simply calls to mind that even though we may have troubles, even though we may have tribulations, nevertheless, God is constant. He is the God of consolation. He is the God of comfort. And it was his prayer that they would feel God's presence and his comfort in their life. And that's what I hope for each one of you. And that's what I hope for myself too. There are times when we get caught up in the world. There's times when we get caught up in the things that we need to do. Sometimes we get depressed by the tribulations both in our own lives and those around us. But let's remember that God has not changed. And God's word has not changed. God is still the God of comfort. He's the God of consolation. And he's near. And hopefully this time that we can spend together, we can spend it in his presence and in his peace. It is November, and that's exciting to me because it's the fall season. One of the things that I love about this time of year is the fact that we have Thanksgiving. But I want to talk about, as is my custom, and I hope that you're not yet tired of it. I don't think we've nearly gotten all the goodness out of the book of Esther, and so this morning I'd like for us to spend some time talking about that. I won't be with you on fourth Sunday. And third, so this is my only crack at getting you a sermon before you celebrate Thanksgiving, if you do so. But before we do that, I'd like to turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 11, and just read a few verses to give us some context about what we're about to read in the book of Esther. The last several days and weeks, my mind has been on the books that deal with the restoration of the people of Judah, the people of God, to Jerusalem. We know that they were carried away captive around 605 by the Babylonians. And God says that he's going to do this as a punishment to them because of their failure to keep the law. The nation of Israel in the north was destroyed. It was absorbed by the Assyrians. But God preserved the nation of Judah and Benjamin and Jerusalem. But nevertheless, through the prophets, he said that nevertheless, destruction's coming. He did this as early as Isaiah, which is interesting. I've often thought it strange. You get to the end of chapter 44 in Isaiah, and he says that Jerusalem shall be built and the temple shall be rebuilt. That must have been very strange to those who were around, 700, 750 BC, 150 years before this happens, that God is saying it's going to be destroyed, but it's also going to be rebuilt. And he even identifies the man by name, Cyrus the Persian, who he calls by name and says, I'm going to lift him up and cause him to restore my people to my land. So there's a lot of good books in the scriptures, a lot of worthy contemplation. The book of Ezra, the book of Nehemiah, the prophets, Haggai, and Zechariah. Those are all taking place in this period of time when God, in the time of the Persians, the Persian Empire, is bringing back his people. And you'll recall that one of the things he said to those who were upset as they began to lay the foundation for the temple. Remember, the temple had been destroyed. It was destroyed in 587, just as the article that you wrote or indicated in our handbook. It was completely razed to the ground. It was destroyed. But God said, I will have it rebuilt. And he encouraged the people to do so. And he said that even though this second temple in Jerusalem is not going to be as great and grand as the one that Solomon had written, he says it's actually going to be better because I'm going to fill it with my presence. I'm going to fill it with my glory. And of course, the Lord Jesus Christ came 500 years later and taught in that very temple. Granted, it had been restored and expanded under the days of Herod the Great, but nevertheless, it was the temple that was being built that God would use to show forth his great name. So let's remember that as we go through any lesson, it's all of the focus ultimately is upon Jesus Christ, the promised Messiah who's going to come. And in Daniel chapter 11, I just want to read a couple of verses here to give you a sense of the time frame. If you look at just the first few verses, this is a prophecy that Daniel receives early in the Persian economy after the overthrow of the Babylonian Empire. Chapter 11 says, "Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I, stood to confirm and to strengthen him." Of course, this is the angel who was speaking, talking about God. And that tells us that when we look around and we see nations that are at war with each other, we see nations and strife and things going on, and it doesn't make sense to you. Well, understand that there's a lot of spiritual strife that we can't see that influence, that there are both good and evil powers trying to cause things to happen. But we need to take comfort in that to know that, nevertheless, God's will and purpose will out. When God says something's going to happen, it's going to happen. And here he said, there are going to be certain kings that come about, and then I'm going to lay aside the Persian Empire, and I'm going to raise up the Greek Empire. So it says that, "And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia," that is, against Greece. "And a mighty king shall stand up and shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those." So what God here is saying is that, look, Daniel, let me tell you what's going to happen in the future. These are the events that are going to take place long after you're dead. But nevertheless, it's sure. He says, right now you've got one king in Persia, and his name was Cyrus the Persian. His father-in-law is Darius the Mede. Okay, so there was a co-regency there. But there were no more Mede kings after that. They were all Persian kings. And the scriptures and history tell us that exactly right. There were three additional kings that came after Cyrus, the one who gave the great statement that said, go back and rebuild the temple. Go back and rebuild Jerusalem. But he says the fourth king of Persia is going to be greater than them all. He's going to be richer. He's going to be more powerful. He's going to be more ambitious. And he, through his works, he's going to stir up the whole world against Greece. And of course, the person we're talking about is the fourth king after the Persian king Cyrus, and his name was Xerxes. Xerxes the Great or Xerxes the First. And you know about him if you've watched any History Channel or if you've watched the movie 300, which I don't attest to its historical accuracy. But it is known that there was a man named Xerxes who was the fourth king of Persia, and he invaded Greece. And it's because of that he was unsuccessful that about 150 years later, a man named Alexander the Great, who again is identified by these scriptures, comes back and goes forth and conquers the world. We just need to remember that God is in control. He has set forth the things and the bounds of what's going to happen. And now what we're going to do is we're going to go to the book of Esther, and we're going to talk about that king Xerxes. We're going to talk about his kingship, his kingdom. We're going to see some things that are shocking. This man, I guess he was a good king. I mean, he was very powerful. In some ways, we're going to find that he was very vain. We can see that he was a man who sought the approval of those around him. He was very trusting in times when he shouldn't have been trusting. It's hard to tell whether he's a fool or an evil man or a little bit of both. But it turns out also that God uses him for his purposes, and he actually turns out and does the right thing. Okay? And if that were true back in 480 BC, it's certainly going to be true today as well. And so I want you all to relax and thank God for his providence. Let's turn to the book of Esther now, and we'll go through it. You should be familiar with this story. I still think it's a wonderful story, and I especially love to read it at the time of Thanksgiving, because it's the background behind a Jewish festival known as Purim. And they carry this out, or they have this festival even today. It's usually in the early spring, usually around February or so. Once you get your new 2016 calendars, you can flip through there. And sometime in February, maybe early March, you'll find Purim on there, perhaps. And if you do, you'll recognize that this is a festival of Thanksgiving, because God once again intervenes and saves his people. Okay? Even though the powers of Satan and hell and death and everything was arrayed against God, the better we can understand that the whole creation is at war, that there's a huge spiritual battle taking place. And nevertheless, God's purposes are going to be fulfilled, and we should be good soldiers following after our great captain. So as we begin reading the book of Esther, we find that it says that it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, and it says, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. Ahasuerus is not his name, it's his title. It's a term that means the king. In Egypt, we had a term called Pharaoh. In the Roman Empire, the emperor was called Caesar, and that's what Ahasuerus is. The individual here is Xerxes, as I said before. He's the fourth that the angel told Daniel would come. And he was greater than all. And you can see that he had the largest expanse of territory, 127 provinces, including Judah. And it says, in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, and we know where that is. We've uncovered that. Archaeologists have gone over and found this palace. They found the ruins of this place. In the third year of his reign, which would probably be around 482 BC, give or take, he made a feast unto all of his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 104 days, 180 days. So he has a six-month feast, a six-month festival. He's gathered in representatives from all over the world to come, all over his provinces, and he's meeting with all of them, and they are doing something. Now, let me suggest to you that although the scriptures don't make this clear, I think it's pretty evident, based on the timing as well as just how this guy works, that he was planning the invasion of Greece, that this was what many scholars believe is going on, and it makes perfect sense. Whether that's the case or not, in one sense, it doesn't matter, but I believe that that is the case. Nevertheless, the scriptures teach us that he is having this large show and this large festival. And once that's over, he has a seven-day wine-drinking contest, kind of an Oktoberfest, as it were. It says, when the days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And it talks about how elegant and how festive it was, where there were white and green, blue hangings, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple and silver rings and pillar of marble. I mean, this was a big show. This was a big deal. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. So you can imagine how festival and colorful this was. The Persians loved a lot of color. And so the floor was tiled with all these different colors, and there were tapestries, and everybody was sitting on gold. So what I want you to see is that the king is really big on making a good showing here. This is really big. This is the splendor of his glory and his beauty. As we continue to read this, though, something happens. And I want to say that as we uncover the scriptures, as we look about this story as well as other stories, it's not true that every single thing that happens happens for a reason. It's not true in God's creation that we're just Autobots and we just automatically do things. But what I want to show you is that God, no matter what it is that we do, he is going to bring about his purposes. Okay? And there are certain things that were foreordained that absolutely had to happen. The crucifixion of Jesus Christ is one that's identified in the scriptures that that's the case. But here, the king gets drunk, and he gets to bragging about how beautiful his wife is, his chief queen, whose name was Vashti. And he commands her to come and appear before him and his rowdy frat boys who were all sitting there. Now, that was an entirely inappropriate thing to do. It was a very undecorous thing to do. Some have suggested that she appear with just her crown on. Okay, so you can think about that. But regardless of whatever it was a great sign of immodesty on his part, bad judgment. And I will warn you that if you drink a lot of wine, you may make bad decisions like he did. But regardless, she refused. And she refused not only for her own sake, but she also refused, if you think about it, she refused because it was for his sake as well. If he had been clear-minded, he would have laughed it off. Everybody else would have nervously laughed as well and gone on down the road, but he didn't do it. This man, because of his ego, because of his position, and because he got some bad advice from some of his counselors, they made a big deal out of it. And so in order for him to save face, he divorced her. He actually at least said that, let her be gone, let her not appear anymore before me, and let's make a writing and send it throughout all the provinces to make sure that everybody knows that if you're a wife, you better obey your husband. Okay, I mean, this is the type of nation that they were living in at that time. And so this writing went out to all 127 as he sought to, stand up and forego his honor and his dignity. It was a very foolish thing that he did, but nevertheless, this is what happened. He's not the first foolish ruler to do something, but nevertheless, God brought about good things. Now, when you get to chapter 2, you find that for some reason, it says, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Again, if you think that this is dealing with the invasion of Greece, we know that that took a couple of years, and he came back dejected because of the great defeat that he had been given both on land and at sea. It would make sense for him to come home and now be in a state of sorrow. So his counselors go to him and say, you know what, he's pining away over Vashti. You might say, well, why doesn't he just tear up his divorce decree? And you know the answer to that. The answer is because among the Persian rulers, the law was that if the king ever gave a pronouncement that was signed and written and stamped, then everybody had to follow it. It couldn't be reversed. It was not possible to do so. We read about that in the book of Daniel, whenever the Mede there in Babylon had promoted Daniel, and he was in charge of all of these other presidents and all of these other princes. And there was a writing that they tricked that king into giving that said that nobody can pray to any god except for the king for 30 days. When Daniel was found to have violated that, they cast him, of course, into the den of lions. The king stayed up all night trying to figure out how to solve that, but he could not. There was no way out. But of course, God had a solution to that. God stayed the mouths of the lions. Daniel was just as safe in that den as he was if he'd been in his own bed. And that shows you again the power of God, even in the midst of the foolishness of men. So he can't just redo this divorce decree. And so instead what he does is his friends say, well, let's find you a new queen. Let's find you a better queen. And so they start having a beauty pageant. They go out through all the provinces to find young women who are eligible and bring them in and subject them to the beauty routine that took about a year to get them ready to be a queen, have them interview, as it were, to be queen. So he's building himself a harem. I'm not espousing this. I'm not saying that this is right. I'm just saying this is what happened. At that point, we find ourselves introduced to a young lady who is a Jewess, a young woman whose name is Hadassah, which is also Esther or Myrtle. And she is among the Jews, and she has a cousin by the name of Mordecai. Mordecai is a central character in this story, as is Esther. Mordecai is an official in the king's palace. He has business to conduct. He shows up, and he has a younger cousin that, because she is widowed, he is taking care of her, and she is summoned to become part of this process. Mordecai gives her some advice. As he says goodbye to her, he's not going to see her again, at least for now, because she's going to become a part of the king's harem. But he says, do not reveal the fact that you're a Jew. Now, that's an interesting thing to say, because at this point, there's no real danger. The Jews have been allowed to return and rebuild. If you go back and study this other, the Jews are well thought of among the nation of Persia. Nevertheless, Mordecai, and I believe this was by the Spirit of God, just had an inkling that said, look, don't tell them that you're a Jew. And it turns out that that was very important, and that was of God. So when we are walking with the Lord, when we're trying to follow after Him, if you get an urge, if you get a feeling, if you feel like there's something you ought to do, don't try to understand that. You ought to search it and make sure that it's coming from God. But there may be wisdom in following the leading of the Spirit. Okay? And here Mordecai did. Now, she went and she submitted herself to this process, and she went in, what's interesting that we read about Esther is that she was a very lovely person. Not only was she very beautiful, but she was also had a very beautiful and gentle spirit. One of the things that the king would do after he interviewed each prospective wife, he would offer them something. He would offer them a gift. He would offer them revenue from cities, or he would give them gold or jewels or anything that they might wish. And each, of course, each woman would take what she desired of that. But Esther didn't ask for anything at all. She said, everything that you provided for me is perfectly fine. I don't want anything. And you young ladies, let me tell you something, that there's something very alluring about that. You know, it really is, right? It is. To have a woman, and it's not to say that we don't enjoy giving you guys gifts, because we want to. We're thrilled to do that. But there's something very, very beautiful and very noble about someone who is content with what they have. It's very interesting. And you're going to find out that this endeared Esther to the king. And again, I think God was moving behind the scenes anyway. But ultimately, she became the head wife. She became the queen over all. And she was indeed very, very beautiful and very wonderful and very gracious. The other thing that happens in this story at this point in chapter 2 is that Mordecai discovers a plot against King Xerxes, that there are two chamberlains. There are two, either they're eunuchs or they're bodyguards or somebody who has access to the king's person. And Mordecai, because of his position in the palace, he learns about this plot and he tells Esther, and Esther certifies it, says, okay, on information given to me by Mordecai, this is going to happen. It gets investigated. It turns out to be true, and those two men are executed. And that's a very important part of the story as well. Again, from Mordecai's standpoint, I don't know. He's living his life. He's doing what he's supposed to do. He's no doubt happy that his daughter, Esther, is the queen. He doesn't get to just walk in and talk to her, obviously. He has to go through intermediaries. He finds out that there's this plot, and he does his duty. He does his responsibility. He receives no reward for it. Somebody who might be more like us might be saying, hey, you know, what is it in it for me? Well, how come you haven't given me a reward or something, or given me a promotion because of my faithful duty? But you'll know, here's the interesting thing about it. If you'll do the right thing and let God promote you, God will give you a much better promotion than you can work out yourself. Okay, so let's do the right thing for the right reason. And let's just move on. And if you do something, if you work hard, if you feel put upon that nobody really recognizes or appreciates what it is that you're doing, well, I can assure you that the Lord does. Okay? And He knows. And if you're treated badly or something happens, you feel like things are just not maybe as fair as they should be, you know what? Commit your life unto God and let Him be the one to raise you up. As we'll see in a moment, these are really important facts and happenings. And again, you can see the providence of God behind all of this. Now, in chapter 3, we're introduced to a man named Haman. Haman, if we were in a synagogue right now and I said the word Haman, everybody would boo and hiss. You don't have to do that. It's okay. If you want to, that's fine. But Haman is a really bad guy. Yeah, Haman is an evil man. Haman is the kind of guy that we see all the time. Okay? The news is full of people like Haman. But God knows how to deal with people like this. Let's let God handle that. We don't need to go out and do something against it. But this is a very bad development, okay? Because Haman is a man. He's an Amalekite, which means he's a son of Esau, and he's a sworn enemy of the Jews. If you go back and read in the days of Moses that the Amalekites attacked the rearward parts of the nation of Israel, and God has made certain pronouncements against them. So there is some hereditary, I guess you'd say, animosity between the Jews and the Amalekites, of whom Haman was. He's an Agagite. But the problem is that Haman is being used by Satan to try to destroy the Jews. Remember, there's more going on here than meets the eye. That Haman is going to be offended by the fact that Mordecai refuses to bow down and worship him as he wants to be. And when Haman realizes that he's among the Jews, he's not content to just destroy Mordecai, which he probably could have gotten away with. But because he had a desire to kill all the Jews, this raging hatred, insurmountable, inexplicable, unreasonable hatred, and nevertheless, this is the kind of guy that he was, he casts lots, he casts what are called pure, hence the name Purim. And he determines, and again, God is in the rolling of dice even sometimes, that God is the one who sets the date upon which all of the Jews are going to be killed out in the future. We're still 8 or 9 months out, or more. It's the 13th day of the 12th month of the year. And so a writing is made. Haman goes to the king. And remember, he's his most trusted servant. He's his number one guy. Why Xerxes promoted him, I have no idea. But just remember, God can work through the details and bring about good, even if wicked men are ruling. And he says, there's a pestilent people among you. There's a group of people that don't obey our laws and our customs, which is not true. But nevertheless, that was the lie. That was the slander that was made. Let me put them away from you. They're harmful to your people. They're pestilent. They're not on board with all of your unity programs. And you need to just let me go take care of them. Let me destroy them. And I'll pay 10,000 talents of silver into your coffer. So you don't lose out on the tax revenue from the destruction of these people. And notice that the king is so uninvolved or so uninterested. He doesn't even inquire as to who they are. He just simply says, well, here's my king. Here's my signet. Go ahead and make a writing. Go ahead and do whatever you think is right. Now, it's good to delegate, guys. But sometimes if you're in a position of authority, you need to kind of investigate and see what your underlings are up to. This was obviously a very wicked thing. And remember what I said earlier about the fact that once you have a signed writing among the Persians, you can't revoke it. Okay? So a writing goes forth under the signal of the king, though Haman writes it, that on the 13th day of the 12th month this year, it's going to be open season on the Jews, that you're permitted to kill any Jew that you can find. And you can take all of his stuff. Now, obviously, Haman, I think, intended to lead the charge on that and to use most of the money and the wealth that he got that to pay off this debt. But nevertheless, there is a writing now that this entire nation is going to be destroyed. And I need to let you know that there are no Jews on the planet that are not under the subject region of the Persian Empire. It's not like the Persians could wipe out some of the Jews, but some would still survive. If this edict goes through, every Jew is going to be wiped out. They're all going to be destroyed. Now think about that for a moment. Obviously, Satan is behind that. And obviously, it's not going to come to pass. It can't come to pass. Not if God was speaking the truth to the prophet Daniel. When he says the nation's going to come along and all these things are going to happen, clearly, this is not going to come to pass. Nevertheless, this is a very, very bad situation. And when Mordecai perceives what was done, this is chapter 4, that is, he reads the writing. It says, Mordecai went, rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and a bitter cry. And he came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gates clothed with sackcloth. And it says that in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews and fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Imagine if there was a decree that said that you and your family are all going to be killed in 6 months. I mean, that's really what this is all about. And there's no recourse. It's not like there's a law that can be changed. It's a done deal. That would be very distressing. That would be very, very sorrowful. That would be intense suffering. You know, you could say, well, I mean, sure, the Jews would read the prophecies and know that everything's going to be okay. No, that's not how the world works. You've got to understand that God doesn't just move in a big way, where he brings about his purposes in a big way. He's also, as the Apostle Paul wrote, he's the God of comforts. He's interested in you, in preserving your life, in helping you in your distress. And so these people correctly cried out to God, and they fasted and they prayed, not knowing what they were going to do, but looking to him for deliverance. And once again, Mordecai, taking a leadership role, went forward and had a conversation with his daughter, the queen, Vashti. Now, they didn't talk face to face because that was not permitted. But through intermediaries, he sent a message to her. And his message was that you've got to go in and talk to the king. You've got to do something about this. Let's begin reading here. It says, so, verse 6, so Hatak, which was the intermediary, this was the eunuch who could go between and carry the message. He would listen to what Esther had to say. And then he would go outside and tell Mordecai, and then Mordecai would tell him what to tell him back. And he was the intermediary. So Hatak went forth to Mordecai under the street of the city, which was before the king's gate. And Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him, and of the sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. Verse 8. And he gave him also a copy of the writing of the decree. Remember, she lives in the palace. She might not have even known about this. I mean, she's isolated in her palace and in her part of the harem. She's not free to just walk around and go in and talk to her king or go talk to anybody else. She's subject to him as well. So this is probably the first time that Esther has learned of this horrible development. So he gave him a copy of the writing of the decree that was given to Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther and to declare it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him and to make request before him for her people. Even though he was his queen, she was still also his daughter. And so he charges her. He says, you've got to go do this. Honey, you've got to go in and do that. And Hatak came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. And Mordecai came unto Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. And it says, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come into the king into the inner court, which is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except as such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. Esther basically, in essence, says, there's nothing I can do. I can't just walk in to the king. He may be my husband. I may be the queen overall, but I don't have any authority or power to even appear in his presence. It's known that if you just barge in on the king while he's sitting in his court, unless he immediately pulls out his scepter to you so that you can touch it and be safe, they're going to immediately drag you off and kill you. That's how sacred, as it were, the presence of the king was. And she says, it's been 30 days. His passions have cooled toward me. I don't even know if he still likes me. If I walk in there, I'm liable to be killed. And that's a very natural fear. That's a very understandable thing for Esther to say. Are you ever afraid? Do you ever feel like, I can't do that, Lord? Don't you know? I mean, remember what Ananias said when he's told to go baptize Paul. Lord, this is Saul of Tarsus, right? He's the one who came to Damascus to throw us all into prison, right? I mean, we're talking about him, right, Lord? And the Lord said, go thy way. He's a chosen vessel unto me. It's going to be okay. And that's what Mordecai says to her too. Mordecai says, then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? What he says is, look, God's going to solve this problem. Okay? But that doesn't mean we can just sit back and watch him do it. We've got to be active when we have opportunity. It says, don't think for a moment that you're going to escape from this. If you don't stand up and do this, then God's going to just save his people, but there's no guarantee he's going to save you. You're going to be destroyed. You're going to be caught up in this, and you're going to lose your life. But he says, how do you know that this isn't the real reason why you're queen in the first place? They must have been thinking to themselves, how in the world did I become queen? And that's something else we need to think about sometimes, is that we don't know what God is doing in our lives. We don't know why he's putting us in certain places. He may not be calling us to do things as great as this, but there's something that God is doing in your life. Your life is not just a meaningless story. This isn't time that we just spend wandering around until we get to go to heaven. We're supposed to be active in his kingdom. And whatever God has put before you, do it with all your heart and all your soul. And there may be a time where God would have you act to take a great risk. And it turns out that is exactly what the purpose of God was all along. You know, if we're faithful in small things, he'll make us responsible for big things. And that's an essence of the kingdom. And here he simply says that you've got to go in and do this, because this may be the very reason that you've been made queen. And so that's very encouraging. Can you see that? That's encouraging. And it's not just encouraging to her, it should be encouraging to us. Let's be brave. Let's not be afraid. I know exactly how she feels, but you know what? When it feels like this is what you're supposed to do, pray to God, look for his counsel, and go. And let him sort it out. Notice what Esther said. Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer, go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. And I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. She said, okay, I'm in, but I need you guys to pray for me. You ever have something hard to do? You ever got something that you are really scared about? Why don't you come to us and say, would you guys pray for me? We spend a little bit of time in prayer, maybe even fasting. Hey, wow, that's radical, huh? But we could do that too. We could do that on your behalf, asking God to give you the wisdom and the strength. That's what we're supposed to be doing for each other. That's what she asked the Jews in Shushan to do. Will you guys pray for me? Pray for me for a couple of days, and I'll do the same. And then I'm going to go. And if I get killed, I die. But I'm going to go. I'm going to be faithful. I'm going to do it. Well, God answered that prayer. And sure enough, it says that on the third day, that she dressed and washed and made herself beautiful and appeared before the king. And the king was very happy to see her. The king graciously extended his rod. That was the first thing. You can't imagine how terrifying that must have been. There's the doorway. She's about to walk around into his sight. One more time, God, this could be the last moments of my life. I mean, that's how dangerous this is. But she walks around and she stands there. And the king's talking maybe, and he looks up and he sees her. And he says, come on, come on ahead. And he extends the rod. And she touches it. And he says, what can I do for you, my dear? I'm paraphrasing for purposes of time. But she says, I would like to have a feast. No doubt, one of the things that she was wondering was that if I survive my interview with my husband, what am I supposed to ask for, Lord? You know, and no game plan showed up. I mean, he didn't fax her a list of instructions. He just put urgings up on her heart, and the best she could come up with was, "Well, I'd like to have a private dinner. I'd like to have a feast. I'd like to prepare a feast for you and for Haman." And he said, "That's great. That sounds wonderful. I'd love to have that." This is the first time she's ever asked for anything, right? And so she goes away, and she prepares for this feast. In verse 3 it says, "What wilt thou, Queen Esther? What is thy request? It shall be given thee even to the half of the kingdom." And Esther answered, "If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him." And then the king said, "Cause Haman to come haste, that he may do as Esther hath said." So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. I don't know if Esther was going to try to get these guys alone and plead her case between the two of these men. I don't know what she thought was going to happen. And I have to just tell you the truth. If you have a different opinion, that's fine. But I think this is as far as the light she had. She knew that she was supposed to have this feast. And as she was sitting there, you can imagine that this wasn't a very fun feast for her to serve, because she's trying to get up the courage to tell the king what's going on, that Haman has plotted against her life. But her faith fails her, or her courage fails her. But notice, it doesn't fail her. She, again, listens to the spirit in her heart, and something tells her to not say it yet. Do you see that? See how she's willing to go, but she's also willing to wait. And sometimes God will do that to you. God will push you forward so far, and then have you wait. Think about when we built this building. How many times did we move forward, and then we had to wait? And then we move forward again, and then we wait. And that's how God does it. And the more we do that, the more we realize that He's going to show us what to do. And he shows her what to do. And so the king, at the end of the banquet, says, all right, dear, what would you like? What is your request? And she says, okay, I'll tell you tomorrow night. Let's have another banquet tomorrow night, and I'll tell you then. And Haman and the king say, that's fine. And notice how alluring this is. I mean, just setting it all aside, if you're a woman and a guy wants to ask you, what would you like? If you keep putting him off, he's really going to want to give it to you. Okay, I'll just say that right now. And that's what's going on. And she says, if I found favor in the sight of the king, if it'll please him, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I'll do tomorrow as the king has said. That's the best she could do. And I honestly think that she, in her mind, was thinking, what in the world am I going to do? I mean, why is tomorrow night going to be any different than tonight? I don't think that she had any insight to that. But she nevertheless followed the leading of the Spirit of God. Now watch what God does. I know you all know the story, but this is so good. God is about to move quickly. And this is what God does. In our lives, we think that, I don't know what we think, but sometimes we just feel like nothing's happening or nothing's going on. And all of a sudden, God moves quickly. Because He's lining up all the pieces. He's doing everything. Notice what happens between now and the next time we have a banquet. Well, first of all, Haman goes home, and he is on top of the world. He is thrilled to death that he got to have a private meal with the queen and Haman. The king. He wants to be king. I mean, it's evident. We'll see that he himself wants to be king, and he is really excited about this, and he is thrilled. But it just so happens it just so happens that as he's leaving the palace, there's Mordecai. And maybe he's around other people and everybody falls down like they're supposed to do, and Mordecai just stands there. And Haman is filled with rage. Do you see how God deals with the wicked in this world? You know, we don't need to go out and take care of the wicked. God is so much better at dealing with that than we need to deal. So it's not up to you to go out and avenge and take down the wicked in this world. Do what is right, because God is going to do it so much better. But notice the fact that God had arranged Mordecai to be there, that now, instead of being all full of happiness, now Haman is really angry. He's like, ah, I hate that guy. Oh, I hate him so much. It's like flames on my fire, on my face. I hate Mordecai so much. So he goes home and he whines to his wife. And his wife says, well, why are you so upset? Why don't you just go ask the king if you can kill Mordecai? If it means that much to you, why don't you do that? You don't have to wait until the end to take care of Mordecai. You can go take care of him now, and then you can kill all the rest of the Jews later. And he thinks that's a great idea. So he sets to building, and he has his workmen construct what is described in the scriptures as a gallows. Okay. Now, I've done some research on this. Well, let's read at verse 12. This is Esther, because I want to get these words. Haman said, moreover, that he's talking to his wife, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet, but she had prepared but himself, myself, and tomorrow am I invited unto her also with the king. I get another one. This is great. Yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then said Zeresh his wife unto all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak unto thou the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon, and then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And this thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. He said, well, why don't you have Mordecai killed tomorrow, and then tomorrow night you can enjoy your banquet. If that's the problem. If you can't enjoy the banquet because Mordecai is breathing, why don't you go take care of that, and then everything will be fine. When it says gallows, I always thought that meant like an Old West gallows. You know, like a crossbar with a rope, and you know, you hang somebody by the neck. And that could be what's under discussion, but I've since seen that might be a little bit different. The Persians did not hang people by ropes. They nailed them to trees. They impaled them. And I think a better understanding of what this is a great big large structure that somehow he intended to fasten Mordecai to it. And notice it's high enough, 75 feet, is that everybody in the city can see it. So he's going to demonstrate his triumph over Mordecai. He's either going to kill him and then hang his body up there, or crucify him, because you know they invented crucifixion. Have him somehow impaled on some sort of big stick. This is a horrifying thing that he has to do. Imagine the wickedness. But yet he probably enjoyed the idea of getting to kill his enemy. All right. Well, any other night, Mordecai might have been in trouble. Any other night, Mordecai might have been done. But you know what? God preserved his life. Mordecai was never in any danger at all. And that's the other thing I want to tell you, is that no matter what's going on around you, you're not in danger. I mean, obviously, there are wicked people out here in this world, but notice the care and the beauty of how, and the style that God rescues Mordecai and destroys Haman. See, the king just had a big banquet. Normally, you'd be sleepy. You probably had a lot of wine. We know he likes to drink wine. We've already established that. But he can't sleep. And instead of calling in for one of his wives to come and spend the time with her, enjoy her company, or have some minstrels come in and maybe play some soothing music, he calls for the reading of the official rolls of the things that happened in his life. And it may be that he was thinking, these will be so boring that they'll surely put me to sleep. Let's go read some IRS regulations. You know, read back to me all the stuff that happened in the past. Maybe that'll put me to sleep. I don't know. But I do know this. That as they read all these different things that happened in his kingdom, they come across the time when Mordecai had saved the king's life. That record was read. And the king said, wait, stop. Read that again. And they said, yeah, a few years ago. Remember, it's been some years. It's not like last week. It's been a while. There was a time whenever the two chamberlains were going to kill you. And here's the thing that was written. Sworn out by Queen Esther that Mordecai had discovered this plot. And he said, well, what did we do for Mordecai? And the king they said, well, nothing. We haven't honored him at all. And so the king is sitting here going, we need to honor Mordecai for this. This is the kind of service that we want. This is the kind of behavior that we want to encourage. And so as the dawn approaches, it's now early morning, and the king is sitting there in his chamber thinking about how he can honor Mordecai. Haman is standing outside, can't wait to get inside, to say, can I kill Mordecai? Isn't that interesting? Isn't that marvelous? Isn't that great how God works? So Haman is standing there ready, and the king calls. They say, hey, there's somebody outside wanting to see you. And he says, well, who is it? He says, well, it's Haman. He says, well, send him in. I need to talk to him. And so they came in, and they approached each other. And Haman, after he says hi, says, I'd like to ask you something. And the king says, well, I'd like to ask you something too. And if you're king, you get to go first. Okay, so the king says, I need you to help me with a problem. What would I do if I had somebody in my kingdom that I wanted to honor? What would be a fitting thing to do for somebody who did a good thing for me, somebody that I would like to honor? And notice again the wickedness of Haman. And notice this is how God takes care of the wicked in this world. Because Haman doesn't for a moment perceive the danger he's in. He doesn't think that he might be talking about anybody else but himself. He says, who else could the king delight in more than me? He's obviously talking about me. So Haman sets up his coronation day. He says, well, you know what? What you ought to do? You ought to have your best noble put your crown on his head, and you ought to put him in your best robes and put him on your best horse and have that nobleman walk through the streets saying, here's a man whom the king delights in. Okay? And, you know, Haman is thinking he's going to be the one who's going to be receiving this. And then the king says, great, that is an excellent idea. Go do that for Mordecai. Okay? And that's when that's when things got really interesting and really funny. Because here's a man who sought to destroy Mordecai, and instead God had that very man honor him. David says that thou preparest a table before me in the midst of mine enemies. That's not just poetic language. God is able to take any situation you're at and solve it quickly and beautifully and with style. And so Haman had no choice. He had to obey the king, and I will hurry this up, but he dressed him in his robes. He put his crown on him. He spent the whole day having to walk around telling everybody how great Mordecai was. And at the end of the day, Haman went home. He covered his face. He was filled with shame. He was filled with dismay. And that's when the people from the palace showed up and says, hey, time for your dinner date. It's time for you to go and have dinner with the king and the queen. Now, this dinner date went down very differently, as you know. This time, Haman is full of fear. He's recognizing that some bad things are happening. And as we continue over here, and we read in chapter 7, it says, the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? It shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom. And then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. It says, but if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. She says, I'm going to ask you for my life. I'm going to ask you to save my life. And I want you to save the life of my people. Says, if we were just being sold into slavery, I wouldn't have bothered you. It was your right. You're the king. You can do whatever you want, but we're going to be destroyed. And so my request is that you'll save us. And of course, the king, taken away by this, and whose heart is filled with inflamed with love for his wife, says, who would dare to threaten your life? Who is the enemy that would seek to destroy you of all people? I mean, you're my favorite. You're my queen. How would you attack? Attacking you attacks me. Who is the enemy? Who dare to presume this? And that's when she can say, this wicked Haman, it's him. And the king's eyes began to become open, begin to understand all the machinations that have been taking place. The king, as we continue the story, the king goes out into the chamber to think about it. His best friend is plotting to murder his wife. He's trying to figure out what to do, all of this. At this moment, this rat, this fink, this disgusting, vile human being named Haman falls at the feet of Esther, begging for his life. How pathetic. Isn't that sad? I mean, where's the honor in that? You can look at the wicked in the world and you can say, man, these guys seem to get away with a lot, but they don't get away with a lot. This is not a way to live. And so she's there, and of course the king comes back in and says, will you even try to force yourself on my wife while I'm gone? I don't think that he really believed that, but it was just so inappropriate that they covered his mouth. And the chamberlain said, well, you know, Haman has built a gallows in town. It was no secret. Haman made it clear what he was going to do. And he was going to hang Mordecai on that. And he says, take him out and hang him on it instead. So Haman was destroyed on that very implement of torture and death. And everybody got to see his dead body hanging up there. With the concluding moments that we have, it's wonderful that God saved us from this situation, took care of Haman and his plot, but the paper still stands. And so what happens is as they continue talking, Esther for the first time reveals to the king who Mordecai is. Mordecai is actually my father, my adopted father. He's the one who's raised me. You can obviously understand the great favor that the king would have for both Mordecai and Esther. Here now they have saved him and taken care of him. He knows that these are loyal, good people. And so he gives Mordecai the position that Haman had. Notice the quick promotion. It's not the first time that's happened in the Bible. Joseph, you know, he toiled for a long time and he was promoted in a position of great authority. Same with Mordecai. So they make a writing. And again, by the Spirit of God, they make a writing that simply says that on the 12th month, the 13th day of the year, it's okay to arm the Jews. The Jews are allowed to fight for themselves and destroy those who would destroy them. And this was published throughout all the land. And remember, Mordecai was just honored in the city of Shushan. So everybody is on board. Everybody's on the Jew side. You know, what looked like a perfectly horrible situation, no way out, is now God has turned the tide just like that. So that now all of the enemies of the Jews are scared to death because everybody is in favor of the Jews. They want to arm them. They want to help them. They want to become Jews. There's a lot of people who convert and become Jews. I mean, they follow after the Jewish religion and the God of the Jews. See how the victory is turned so quickly, so fast, from a position of great darkness to a position of great light. And of course, as you continue reading the rest of the book, we find that that day did come, that all the family of Haman was destroyed as well as many of the others. Although they didn't do a wholesale slaughter, the Jews did not go out and destroy everybody and steal their stuff. The genocide that was planned was not followed through with, but they did take care of the destruction. They did take care of the threat, and God's name was glorified. And as a result, they began to have this feast of Purim, which they hold to this day. It's a day of Thanksgiving where they have a feasting and they give gifts to one another, and they sit back and they reflect upon the providence of God. And that's the word that really is present here, providence, the provision of God. God's providence is the same in our lives. It may not be quite these circumstances, but if you'll sit back and look, you can see that both individually, as a family, as a church, and as a nation, God has moved in your life in miraculous, wonderful ways. And it's appropriate that God's people come together and celebrate Thanksgiving, a giving of thanks to God. So as we celebrate this year, as we gather together at the fourth Thursday this month, let's have a Thanksgiving in the same spirit as the book of Esther. Let's give grace and thanks unto God, Almighty God, for His great providence, His ability to save us. This God of all comforts, who is able to not only comfort us, but deliver us out of every trouble that we have. Let's praise Him and thank Him and be grateful to Him. There are many things, there are many reasons for us to be sad. There are many reasons for us to be alarmed at the things going on in the world. Don't worry about it at all. Don't spend one moment worrying yourself sick about that. Instead, put it in the hands of God and trust Him and let Him lead you in your spirit. And you know what? You might be in a position where you can actually help, just as Mordecai and Esther did. I thank you for your kind attention. May God bless you, and I hope you have a very wonderful, happy Thanksgiving.